and welcome to Manx Radio, where you're listening to our general election candidate interview series. I'm Amy Griffiths, and I'm our election producer here. There are now just 9 weeks to go until the island heads to the polls to decide who should have a seat in the House of Keys. Before then, we're inviting all the candidates to take part in a 30-minute interview to tell us why they deserve your vote. Today we're hearing from James Hampton, who's standing in Glenfaber and Peel. He's been speaking to Sian Cowper.
Today I'm talking to James Hampton, who's seeking election in the constituency of Glenfaber and Peel and standing for the first time in that constituency. James did previously stand unsuccessfully in 2016 for Rushen. So James, I guess the first question then is, why Glenfaber and Peel this time?
Because that's where I live now. I moved to Peel a few years ago, bought a house down on Factory Lane. So, so that made sense. That's now my home. I'm there for the long haul now.
Now, you stood in 2016, but not in 2021. Why was that?
Life was a little bit busy in 2021. There was a lot of stuff going on with kids and family and stuff. So, yeah, it wasn't really an option then. So I guess now I have the opportunity to come back and think about these things a bit more. And interestingly, I think, you know, a lot of the core ideas I had in 2016 have remained pretty much the same. A lot of the stuff that I was talking about then has sort of come to fruition, I think. So, yeah, it was an interesting sort of idea to come back to the same sort of position, I guess.
Now, you describe yourself as a professional jack of all trades. So what is that? What is your background?
My background is a degree in architecture, and then realising I didn't want to sit behind a desk for my whole life. So went off on a bit of what I think the kids call a pivot and did a taught master's degree essentially in development planning. And from there, was going to sort of run away to Africa, but ended up back on the Isle of Man for various different reasons and ended up working originally in cabinet making and then moving into sort of heavy carpentry. So when I came back in 2008, set up my own business, it was mostly in heavy carpentry originally. And then, as I say, because of my background, I've sort of spread out into lots of different areas. So I've done pretty much everything. I was the main carpentry contractor on rebuilding the Laxey Wheel. I did a lot of work for Manx National Heritage, but I also do planning and building regs applications, all sorts of unusual civil engineering projects. Like, I was asked to put the new security scanners in at Ronald's Way. So I do, yeah, pretty much anything I'm asked sort of thing.
Now, you have published a manifesto already. Mm-hmm. You say that almost every problem essentially can be traced to the structure and the format of government itself. So in your mind, then, what should the format and structure of government be?
Well, it's quite interesting because the core of the idea, as I said in the manifesto, is actually really beautiful. This idea that you've got 24 MHKs who bring together their constituents sort of perspective and amalgamate it into this thing like that is approximately the will of the public. That's actually really beautiful. It's way better than the swing of party politics. The problem is that there's no accountability and no sort of counterbalance, and it's difficult to achieve that without party politics. So it's basically, well, how do we solve that problem? Because in my mind, when you start asking, like, why, you know, eventually you get back to this, the way that this process of decision making happens. And from my perspective, it's inherently weak. If you can't sort of explain how you've made the decision, how you've reached this position, that's a position of weakness. And I think that weakness then filters down through everything. It makes everything defensive. It makes everything protected. And so, as I say, the problem is that you can't achieve this counterbalance or this accountability without sort of an opposition. And that's what has been identified for a long time is missing. So how do you bring in that accountability and that opposition sort of position? To my mind, the only real effective way to do that without eliminating the beautiful bit of our system is to bring the public in. To bring the public in, not to be like a consistent manager. That's not the idea at all. That I think that maybe I didn't explain that well enough last time. Not to be a consistent manager, not to be sort of constantly in negotiation with government, but simply to have the power to do something about it. And by having that power, you improve the other side of the equation, because if government knows that the public have this power to do something about this, you fundamentally change everything from the get-go, from the very first decision through the whole process happens with the awareness that the public could do something about this. So it improves everything. It will improve the philosophy of everything. That's my hope anyway. That's the way that I look at it. And I look at it that way because of other systems that I've looked at which have that, you know. that sort of that basic kind of relationship between government and the public is fractured at the moment, or was just never considered. And I think there's a reason that it was never considered in the first place, because when this current system was implemented in 1990, we were in a completely different position. Like, as a society, we were in a very different position. We weren't dealing with the same problems that we're dealing with now. And it's because we're dealing with a whole different set of problems that the weaknesses in the current system have become so much more apparent. So that's how I got to where I am, yeah.
So in terms of that power for the public then, what would that look like, and how would you go about bringing that in?
So Lord Lisvain said, the first thing that Lord Lisvain said in 2016 when he came in and reviewed the functioning of Tynwald was that one of the key things he said, was that the public should have a say on a programme for government. So at the moment we don't. So at the moment, you know, this process goes on initially, this collection of the Chief Minister, the creation of the government, and then in theory the sort of production of this programme for government. And they produce this set of ideas, and then that's it. They just get on with it and run away with it. Nobody has any say over which direction we're heading in. And because of that, because nobody really knows where we're going, that's a problem as far as I can see. So the first thing one of the things that Lisvain said was that the public should have a say on that programme for government. Otherwise, how does the government know that it's heading in the right direction? And then the second thing is that if we all do agree, yes, okay, we've got this programme for government, everybody's happy, or not everybody's happy, everybody understands that this is an amalgamation of ideas, because it's not, as I say, this is the main benefit over a party politics system. It's not we're heading in this direction or this direction. It's not we're going left or we're going right. It's more likely to be an amalgamation, which is far, far more efficient and far less risky, far less dangerous. So it's an amalgamation. And so we've got this. Yes, we agree this. We understand that not everybody's going to get what they want, because that's the nature of the beast. But we've got this agreement, we know where we're heading, we know how we got to that decision, we know how we created this amalgamation. If it then unfolds, as we see all the time, that it's not going the way, that there has to be some stop, there has to be some accountability to go, no, actually, you said you were going to do this and you're not doing it. At the moment, there's no way, like we see this in so many areas now, like the government says it's going to do something and then doesn't do it. So there has to be some way to go, no. So the model that I looked at that I really liked is the Swiss model. Now, the Swiss model is very complicated, so I basically distilled it down to just one principle, the principle that the population can say, we're not happy about this, something's gone wrong here, or we want this or we don't want this. If you reach a certain threshold, it has to be a reasonable threshold, because you don't want it to be about faff. It has to be a certain number of people. That number of people signs a petition or signs a document to say, we want something to change here, we want to have a vote on this. The next stage has to be that the government has to have the chance to respond. So the government is then made formally aware that there's a problem. They're not following the programme for government, or something has happened that the people aren't happy about. The government has to have a chance to respond, to A, explain why it's gone wrong, because maybe there's, you know, and again, we're back to this idea of transparency, and B, say, okay, well, here's an alternative, because that's how the Swiss system works. Here's an alternative to what you think, or here's the consequences of what you think, blah, blah, blah. If that doesn't resolve it, because that can resolve it then, that can, like, okay, we've had a debate, we've had a proper political debate, which we don't have on the Isle of Man. If that doesn't resolve it, then there's a national vote. Now, I think that because of the power structure that I'm talking about, if you implemented it, because it would change the other side of the debate, I think it would be relatively rare, because, of course, they'd be aware that there's this potential. But it could obviously still happen. And if it happens, then the public should have the authority to, you know, say, no, you're going in that direction because that's the direction that we said. This is what we agreed. This is the deal we made with you. And the other part of that, again, is transparency. The government, this idea that we're holding people in ignorance is dangerous. And you can see that with discussions about immigration and all sorts of other things where the vacuum, the information vacuum that we're dealing with is filled by other people, which we really don't want. So if we just put everything on the table, it's not all going to be like we want. But if you hold that information back, you're holding society in ignorance, which is extremely dangerous. So this idea is based on the fact that the public should know everything, because otherwise, how are we going to learn? How are we going to sort of progress as a society? We hear this all, our lessons have been learned. Lessons have been learned by who? You know, where is the record of this? Because we know that that doesn't work. So if everything is on the table and the public has access to all the information and the public can make decisions, we need to move away from this idea that the public are not capable of making decisions, that the public don't understand. It's like, well, I'm not sure that the people in charge are any, you know, there's a problem there with your philosophy. So yeah, that's the core, is that I think that the public should have the capacity to go, because I think that that's the only way to balance the current format. And I love the current format in principle, this amalgamation of ideas, you know, principle, but there is a fundamental problem in terms of balance. So that's all I'm really suggesting is that with a little tweak, we can, you know, and I know that some people go, oh, well, you know, you're talking about have a referendum, Brexit's terrible. So, well, a single issue referendum is worse than no referendum, because in essence, it's where the power lies. Like, so if you have the opportunity to call a referendum on anything, but you then have the opportunity to call another referendum after, if things don't go as you want, that's a process of learning. And, that's in essence what I'm talking about, is that, you know, you can't just have a referendum on a single issue, because there's manipulation and there's disinformation. You know, it's a terrible idea because it's a gun to the head. If you change the idea, as I say, more towards the Swiss system, where the public can have the referendum on anything at any time, it significantly reduces the potential for misinformation and sort of, you know, the wrong outcomes. Because, okay, we've made the wrong decision. What happens next? Okay, we made the wrong... So a good example is Switzerland has just had a vote on a population cap. Very, very topical. It didn't go the way that the people who called the vote wanted, which is another good example. If in 5 years' time it's not panning out as they want, they can just have another referendum. Now, that sounds a little bit kind of labour intensive, but what is the alternative? The alternative is what we see elsewhere, which in my opinion is, you know, a bit of a war zone. You know, it's not this kind of idea that we're swinging back and forth and we've got, you know, people going to more and more extreme positions. The people dragging us to those positions, they're not interested in the outcomes. The people in the middle are interested in the outcomes. It's me, it's you, it's, you know, it's the people. So that's the sort of core of what I'm trying to get to, I guess.
In terms of the time that would take, though, we already know the legislative process can be a bit cumbersome at times. It's not always the quickest. Is this not just going to slow things even more?
In terms of if the public called a vote, or just in terms of so to go back a step, essentially what we're talking about is just the power to be the counterbalance, to be the accountability. If, for example, the public called for a law that they wanted, essentially, that's no different than an existing member of the House is seeking permission for a private member's bill. Ultimately, what we're talking about is, why are we doing this? And so, to that regard, the time that the process takes, the politicians will then carry that process forward on the basis of the public making their will known. So, in that regard, there's no different to the current legislative process. Or were you asking more specifically about the process of the timing of the referendums, the actual running through a referendum in theory? Or
an element of that also, though, you mentioned a binding vote in relation to the programme for government. So in terms of with that, government would have to put its programme together,
yes,
then go out to
yes.
the public and wait to find out what it's doing before it can actually start doing it.
Yes, that's a fair point. So that would be effectively an additional part of the process. And I don't think there's any way around that. Basically, that comes down to do the public think that that's a worthwhile investment of time? Because it is at the moment, you know, there is a period when the current government's dissolved, and then the new government's formed. There's a whole period this summer where, you know, the ship is essentially unmanned. Not, you know, it's unmanned politically. So that's part of the natural cycle anyway. And yes, if I want to add in a vote on the programme for government, I know that some people are going, oh my God, not, you know, that's that classic reel from the Brexit situation. Not another one. And so all I can say is, well, the alternative is that you just don't get a say. And you know, if you're happy with how things are going right now, if you think that everything's fine, then I'm not the candidate for you. You know, so I think if you look at all of the really significant problems we're facing, the only realistic way we have to address that is to change the way we make the decisions. And I think this is key. So if the new government forms a programme for government, let's just say I'm nothing to do with it. New government forms a programme for government at the end of this year. Nobody has any say on it, and they've decided that they're going to slash health services because they have the power to do that. do you want to say on that or not? Like, that's essentially what it boils down to. The next administration could come up with a programme for government that nobody's happy with. There's nothing within the current system which stops that. You know, we're all you know, you see all over social, oh, it's time we vote them all out. It's time we get rid of all these people. Yes. And let's say that all the ones that you don't like all get their seats back. And I'm absolutely not for this idea that it's the politicians. I don't believe that at all. I don't think you can make any reasonable argument that it's the politicians. I think it's entirely the system. But the fact is that there's nothing stopping all the people that you don't like being voted back in and them being in, you know, having their hands on the levers next time. So unless you have this opportunity to say, now, because of my position, there's nothing that I can do about that for the next administration. If I got voted in, I'd be there in September, October, and all I can do is present a demonstration of what I think, how I think this should go at this point. I won't be in a position to do anything about it in October, because that's just, again, the nature of the beast. So all I can do is show how this might work at that point. And hopefully if I show how it might work, how it could work, in the next administration, if we do something about it between now and then. This is a long process. I'm not expecting to just, you know, it to just sort of materialise. And I'm not expecting it to be perfect at the first go either. I expect it to be, you know, there to be bumps in the road. I expect there to be mistakes. But there are mistakes happening right now that we can't do anything about. So it's essentially how, you know, how do you want your mistakes? Do you want your mistakes that you can do something with, or do you want your mistakes that, you know, you can't really do anything about? So...
in terms of the public having more say, do you think the chief minister should be elected by the public?
I'm not convinced. So if I got the changes that I'm talking about, because I think that would fundamentally change everything that happens before that point, I don't really believe, because I don't see how you would do it. I think it would become, that would become quite difficult. I think, let's just say that the next chief minister is any of the current candidates. If that chief minister is aware of the fact that eventually they're going to have to A, publish a programme for government, and B, then face the public as a backstop, as the counterbalance, then that changes everything that happens before that point. Because at the moment, everything that happens before that point, from the election of the chief minister through to the setting of the, you know, departments and memberships, blah, 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 that all happens behind closed doors. And, you know, if you know anything about how it happens, it's quite a cloak and dagger kind of process. If the end game is a vote on a programme for government and the public being the counterbalance, then everybody who's in that process from the very beginning knows that the outcome is different. Like, you're not just going to be able to run with this. I think if we had that, it changes the dynamics of selecting the next chief minister. I don't think it would be necessary for the public. I mean, ultimately, if the powers that I propose were in place, the public could say eventually, no, we think you've made the wrong choice there. That would be within the remit of what I'm talking about. But I don't think it's necessary, because I do quite like the essence of the current system, this amalgamation idea. I think that's really beautiful. And I think it's also really beautiful in terms of selecting a leader, and I think it promotes better leadership. If your leader is leading because they just have the authority through collective responsibility, that's not a good position for leadership. That's not like, this is my idea, and I have to convince you that this is the right idea, and we have to move forward. That's not a good, you know, the opposite, this idea of I'm the leader, I have collective responsibility, you must do, we can see that over and over again, that does not work, because it's not a good way to lead people.
In terms of some of the other bits you touch on in your manifesto, you talk about departmental membership and perhaps the need for some more backbenchers. Why is that?
Well, again, it's not really to do with, you see, again, because we have this really unusual little system where, you know, as Liz Vane sort of pointed out, you know, you've got around 80% of the current House essentially in government. That makes the problem of backbenching and opposition difficult. And as I say, I'm not convinced that there's another solution. That's the problem. I've thought about it from every different angle. Like, I do understand the fact that there's a significant workload for these people. You know, if you get into it, you've got a job on. It's not easy. You do need support, and you're going to need to have, you know, multiple eyes on this situation, blah, blah, blah. So I'm not convinced by the idea of stripping out, you know, the people who need to do the work. What I am convinced of is that they should have in the back of their mind at all times, we made this deal and we need to stick to it. Because if you bring that in as a part of the philosophy, then you've solved kind of a big part of the problem. And I think that would even then touch on collective responsibility, because the essence of collective responsibility is that it improves the efficiency of the decision-making process. Okay, that is true. That we have to agree on this and we have to get stuff done. Great. We have to get stuff done against the backdrop of if we get it wrong. And so I think collective responsibility in essence is fine, because you do have to, we've got to get on. We've got to present a united front and we've got to get on with stuff. Okay. But you have to have in the back of your mind that this stuff has to be good. We have to be doing what we said we were going to do. We have to be, we're not fudging it. We're not forcing it through. So it's about that balance of, philosophy, basically. So I don't really have a problem with the way that this chief minister is currently elected if there's a counterbalance.
You talk in your manifesto about service cuts and who decides how those could potentially be made, what could be outsourced. Do you believe there do need to be cuts in government?
Well, as I said in my manifesto, it's the reality is that nobody knows, and that's another massive problem, because government is this massive, disjointed, multi-headed, beast. Nobody has a real picture, and again, that's in my manifesto. That's one of the things that I've promised to do, is to try and create a picture. I have a background in design. I look at this situation and go, well, we've got how many thousand people have we got working for government? Nobody actually really knows. what is the structure? Nobody really knows. There is people who know what all of the various different bits look like, but there's no unified picture. And again, this goes back to the single legal entity discussion, again, because they're all separate empires. You're in this mess of those photographs you see of the old telephone exchanges with all the wires going in different places. If you just go in there and start ripping wires out, the chances are you're going to make an even bigger mess. So you have to try and get some sort of picture. And I like working visual, so I like a picture. I like a family tree. I think until we get this family tree, until we understand how everything's interconnected, we've got no chance. I don't understand how, this is the problem with the budgetary process, is you've got people in, offices in Treasury in different places saying, oh, this is how we're going to do this and this is how we're going to do that. And the people at the other end of the scale, the people with their hand on the shovel or their, nurse's uniform on, they actually know how this actually all unfolds. But there's currently essentially no communication between those two people. So, I don't see how anybody could say, it's another thing that you see on social media. We're just going to go in and slash everything. We're just going to go in and just fire random people. What do you do? Well, I don't like what you do. Yeah, but that's connected to that and that's connected to that. And that. Until we get a picture, definitely, I think there's definitely the opportunity for more efficiency. So one of the things that's different for me this time than last time is I've done quite a lot more contracting for government. I do quite a lot of contracting work for government. And so I've been in various meetings, classic government meeting. You're trying to solve a question with one or more government departments, and you end up in a meeting with 12 people. And you're looking around, there's probably one or two people here that I need to speak to. Who are the rest of you? And usually they're people there with their arms folded, not going to actually answer the questions. And that, again, comes down to this problem with the structure of government. So almost certainly the answer is yes, there is a lot of overlap. There's a lot of things that could be made more efficient, but the people who know where that overlap is and know how he's doing this job and he's doing that job, and they're the people on the front line. They're the people who understand exactly how these things, and I think until we have a conversation with those people and until we build up a picture, an actual picture of how it all works, we've got no chance of actually sort of, because the people at the top are just, we're just going to save £10 million. Okay. and it's because it's an unrealistic target, I think.
Now, you talked as well about wanting all legislation and policy to be published as standard. Are you a bit surprised that that's not the case already?
No, because I think this goes back to this weak position that we start with, because everything starts in a position of defence, because everything starts with we need to have this kind of position where we can't talk about this and we can't talk about that. It's no surprise, really, that's exactly what I'm talking about, really. That mindset, that philosophy seeps through everything. So you get this defensive position on everything, which is really, really corrosive. You can see that everywhere. Again, going back to what I was just saying about, I've been in meetings with government workers, and I'm not somebody who slates civil service. I absolutely not, because I've been on jobs with civil servants at 3 o'clock in the morning and said to them, are you getting paid for this? No. You're here not being paid. Yeah. And I've also been in this in meetings with those same people where there's people from other departments who are trying to get to help in this situation or answer a question, and they're sitting there with their arms folded. So there's two sides of this. You know, there's definitely people in there working their socks off, and there's also people who are just not making the effort, shall we say, because they don't have to, because that's the way it's structured. So to go back to the question about am I surprised? No, because it starts at the top. It starts at this defensive position of, you know, we can't talk about this. You know, and until we get over that, until we get past that, it's nothing's going to change. It can't, because that's the start point.
Now, we've got a few minutes left before we finish, and I have to ask, I think this is the first manifesto I've ever read that mentions international cat smuggling.
AI, what's that all about? AI warned me that this is the question. AI read my manifesto before I published it and said, initially it said that my About Me page read like a tragic midlife crisis brag sheet, and it was right. It was absolutely right. So I trimmed it down, and then it said, now I trimmed it down again, and it said, you're going to be asked about that. That's the one thing in my manifesto I can't talk about, because it actually happened.
It would get you in trouble.
Yes. No, it happened a long time ago. I did actually once get paid for moving cats.
Well, we'll move
you
on know, from
you
that
asked
then.
Me initially about my my range of work. I was once paid to move cats. Yeah.
Well, just before we finish, talk to us about developing a new public forum. That's quite an interesting angle.
So I don't want to get too, because I think the last time I stood, I got a little bit sort of too involved in the technical side of what could be done. And I don't want to, you know, I had some people working with me then and they were brilliant. And we developed a website and we developed a process. Essentially, this time I'm focusing more on the philosophy of, because that's essentially where I started. Because I know that it can be done. Like, I know that technically in 2026, what I'm talking about is child's play, really. Like, I'm not a computer person at all. I run my own business, but I'm not involved in programming or anything like that. But even I can program, you know, a spreadsheet to ask questions and generate codes and blah, blah, blah. That's not, you know, rocket science. People who know what they're doing can, you know, there's so many different ways that this could be resolved now. So when I stood in 2016, I was naive on a lot of things. One of the things that I was naive on was social media, because this is 10 years ago. Social media now is clear that it's fantastic for some things. It's just really not good at making progress on ideas, on building things, because of the scroll nature. Once it's off the bottom of the screen, that's it. So you're not going to build anything off that. It's very good for making a noise, for having that. It's like going into a pub. Social media is like going into a pub. You can sit there and you can chew the fat and you can get everything off your chest. And the people making the most noise have probably been in there the longest and are probably... So you just need to take all that as it comes. Like, you need to look at it and go, yep, this is great. It's like having a pub. If you actually want to build something, you've got to have something a bit more permanent. And so I think that that's entirely possible. I think everybody understands that we can have digital presence, but also a physical presence of talking to people and developing ideas and publishing things. Like, none of that is really rocket science in this day and age. So yes, my intention is if I got elected, that would be something I would personally help to develop on the basis of a cooperative as well, because another part of the problems that you see on social media is you get one person who controls this little group and who manipulates what happens in it. And I really don't like that. I like, that's a sort of antithesis of what I'm talking about. So I think it should be built, and it should be cooperatively owned. It should be democratically run. And I think, you know, most people can understand that, hopefully.
So with a minute left then, what would be your message to the voters in Glenfaber and Peel?
If you're happy with the way everything's going, I am not your candidate. If you want to actually change something, that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about trying to tweak the format of the way things run, not throwing everything in the bin, just make some little adjustments to bring in accountability, to bring in transparency, to try and just get us turn the corner and moving in a positive direction. Because I think we've got so much to give. We could be so, you know, incredible the way that we run things, so unique, such a good example to the world, if we just make some teeny tiny little adjustments. And I know that there's risk, and I know that it won't be perfect, but I think the alternative is not looking good. So that's why I'm here.
That was James Hampton, who's standing for election in Glenfaber and Peel. Also standing in the constituency are Katrina Baptist, Trevor Cowan, Colleen Dale Beaton, and Alex Perriam. This interview, along with all the others recorded as part of this series, will be available shortly after broadcast from your usual podcast provider. And if you head to manxradio.com, you can find everything you need to know about the general election on our dedicated website.